Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 4th of May. First of our program today, we're going to be talking about what's going on in Louisiana and along the Gulf Coast. The latest news from Reuters is that BP is struggling to stop oil gushing unchecked from the ruptured underseas well in the Gulf of Mexico. Calmer weather has raised hopes of reducing the massive oil slick and limiting its impact on the U.S. shoreline. The leak, though, which is spewing from the ocean floor at a rate of more than 5,000 barrels a day, threatens shipping, still wildlife, beaches, and one of the most fertile U.S. fishing grounds. There are a number of issues here. I think probably one of the dominant issues of this hour, the accident really has brought into focus this politics of dealing with U.S. energy security with protecting the environment and industries that depend on it, like fishing, which makes it a very, very difficult issue. We have three guests with us this hour. We're going to start with Tom Bearden. Tom is in Louisiana. He has been reporting the last few days, a correspondent reporting from Louisiana on the impact of the Gulf Coast oil spill. And he's been meeting with people who fish in that area and talking about how they may find another form of livelihood, at least temporarily. He's a correspondent for PBS's The News Hour. Later, we'll be speaking with the regional coastal advisor for Louisiana State University's Agricultural Center and Louisiana Sea Grant College Program. And still later, we will speak with the co-owner of the Mariah Jade Shrimp Company. Everybody joining us today from Louisiana. Tom, thank you very much for being with us. I read the report from Reuters this morning. What are you seeing in terms of where this may hit land and whether or not it seems to be at least a little smaller today than people thought it was going to be? Tom, are you there? Hello? We'll try to reach him again. We'll be welcoming phone calls for our guests as well. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send us an email, then you could do that. That is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
There. I'm fine. How are you?
Tell
me how things are looking there today. The early reports that we're getting are that it looks just a little bit better. I don't know compared to what, but the slick is contained just a little bit. The weather has cooperated some. Is it a more optimistic picture today or not?
I think, yes, there is some optimism because, as you said, the weather is has beginning to die down. The problem for the last several days has been very high winds and high seas, 7, 8, 9 foot waves. Or sea states out where the oil slick is beginning to come to, or has been coming to the surface. That causes problems with the containment booms, which have been strung along shorelines. Sometimes they come loose and they wash ashore. Their purpose is to provide a physical barricade between the water and the land. And when they uproot themselves, obviously the barricade is breached. Mm-hmm. We're hearing reports that the wind has shifted now from the southeast to more northerly winds, and that is not driving the oil toward the shore, but doing the opposite, pushing it somewhat away.
And yet you never know what's going to happen from day to day.
That's absolutely true, and there are also currents in the Gulf of Mexico that have to be taken into account as well. In fact, we're hoping to pursue that some more today with people from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration to try to get a more detailed explanation of how all this works.
The other things that are happening, and I'm not sure when these are about to happen, BP is figuring out ways to plug these leaks, that they're going to try and get some kind of cement into it to plug one of the holes. There are domes that they are, what, currently building, or they're on their way?
Well, there's one dome that's completed, as far as I can tell. It's in a place called Port Fouchon, which is about 2.5 hours away from where we are in Venice, Louisiana. That looks like sort of like a two-story, very heavy steel cottage, if you will, with a pointed dome on the top, kind of like an Egyptian obelisk, if you will. And it's very heavy, and it has to be transported out to the site. And then the idea is they lower it over one of the three holes that is in the pipe that once went to the surface. And then if that's successful, it captures the oil as it comes out of the hole, and then it's piped to the surface and stored on a ship. There are supposed to be three of those eventually. I believe one is about ready to be deployed, but these things move very slowly, and that's been our experience in the week we've been here.
Did they just have to build them, or were they in place already?
They had to build them. They've been fabricated over at Port Fouchon. The cement you were talking about and the mud and so forth, that's right. A relief well that started drilling on Sunday, and that's the mitigation that may take up to 3 months to complete.
3 months.
That's correct.
Did people have plans in place for this kind of catastrophe? Were they not required to plan for a worst-case scenario?
Well, everybody who is involved in the cleanup effort says, yes, the plans were in place. And the Coast Guard has a number of representatives here from what's called the Atlantic Strike Force, which its main job is to contain oil spills. And they've been stockpiling the boom material. There's two kinds of boom material. There's the heavy plastic ones, which are a physical barricade, and then there are the absorbent ones, which are designed to soak up the oil. They get removed and hauled away, and new ones put in place. There is a rather large logistical operation that is in place now, and all of that was proceeding from previous plans. Whether or not those plans were adequate, I think, is going to wait the judgment of history, probably.
Yes. Tell us about the meeting that you went to between representatives of BP and several hundred fishing boat captains.
That was a rather contentious meeting. There were about 400, perhaps up to 500 people there, fishing boat captains, and some of them with their families. BP called the meeting for 5 o'clock, but there was a problem with the contract forms themselves. The idea was that they would distribute these standard contracts among the fishing boat captains, which specify a rate of remuneration for the use of their boats during the day and also ways to recover the expenses, the rather extensive fuel expenses that they would incur doing this. And when the forms finally did arrive an hour later, as you might imagine, the crowd was pretty anxious, and they surrounded the sheriff's deputies who had been detailed to hand out the forms, and it got a little anxious there for a while because people were upset, they're concerned, they're frightened, and more than a few of them were pretty angry. But they eventually got the forms there and started distributing them, and the fishermen we talked to after the meeting seemed to be satisfied with the rate of compensation, but then there's been a dispute about that since, and that's going to go on, I'm sure, for months.
Right. What did BP mean? And I know the president has been pressing BP on this. They said on Monday they would compensate people for legitimate and objectively verifiable claims from the explosion and the spill. What does that mean?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not sure I can define that for you. They said a couple of days ago they were entertaining those claims now. There's a rather interesting ripple in all this. Back after the Exxon Valdez accident, Congress passed legislation which it established a fund, a disaster fund, which right now I've read has about $1 billion in it. But at the same time, it also limited an individual oil company's liability for problems beyond the actual cleanup itself to $75 million. At that point, that fund is supposed to be tapped. Well, clearly both $75 million and a $1 billion fund are nowhere near what the claims are going to be from the people whose lives have been affected here.
Right. And tell me more about those lives. There's no fishing now in a pretty large area in federal waters. Is that continuing for a long period of time, or is it taking day-to-day observations?
Well, NOAA yesterday, I think it was yesterday, it may have been the day before, I'm not sure, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration closed the fishing area, which is essentially most of the Gulf from the panhandle of Florida all the way over to Louisiana, and that's for 10 days. They will certainly evaluate the conditions at the end of that period and decide whether or not they will continue it, and that, of course, is dependent on what happens with the slick. The areas west of the Mississippi River, which a Fishermen's Association told us in a press release the other day, comprise actually 77% of the resources of the Louisiana fisheries, remains open.
Oh, really? 77%?
Yeah. And what
about the people who are not able to fish right now and they don't know what's happening? Can you imagine being in that situation? You can't work. What do you do for money? You've already been through horrible hurricanes. I mean, it's rather devastating, isn't it?
Devastating, whatever other adjective you'd like to apply to it. I mean, these are people who, as you said, have been through the worst possible situation anybody could imagine, and it comes at the worst possible time. I spoke to one fisherman who has invested his last $65,000 getting his shrimp boat ready for the shrimping season, which was supposed to get supposed to start a couple of days ago. And his boat is now idled on a dockside, and he doesn't know how he's going to feed his family. It's not uncommon. That's not an uncommon story, that folks who fish for a living have everything they own, all of their resources invested in the boat, and if the boat doesn't go out, they don't have income.
Right. And then just finally, obviously this is going to, as the months continue here, bring into further debate this, how do we balance energy needs in the United States with protecting the environment and all of the industries, the people you just mentioned? And this is a difficult issue.
It certainly is. And if you're speaking specifically about the people who live here in South Louisiana, they're between a rock and a hard place. I mean, yes, fishing is a very important part of their economy, but so is the oil business. And when the president declares a moratorium on new drilling, that's of great concern to the people who make their living out of the oil fields, too. So couple that with the oil spill affecting not only fishing but also tourism, and you've knocked the chocks out from the underneath the entire economy of this area.
Yes. And what about the president's credibility when he was calling for increased offshore drilling? Now all of that's probably being examined again, isn't it?
Well, if you listen to the White House press releases, yeah, they're looking at that, but they don't seem to be inclined to back away from what the president said a few weeks ago, that he is he wants to promote more energy exploration, and not just in the Gulf Coast, but also in Alaska and along the East Coast. There's a great controversy that was that took place when he made that announcement from the folks who live on the West Coast of Florida who don't want to see drilling there. Here in Louisiana, the oil business is a great friend of the local economy, and so people are torn by that conflict.
Yes. What are you looking at today, Tom?
Well, as I said, we're going to see if we can find somebody from NOAA to tell us more about how the ocean currents and the Geyer effect, if you will, affect the movement of the oil and what sort of impact the weather has on it. We're also going to look into the logistics of trying to contain a spill like this. I mean, literally thousands of people will be coming down here to work on this, and they have to find places for them to live and sewers to carry away their waste and food to feed them and all the things that come from creating a town pretty much overnight.
Yeah. Thank you, Tom, so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Tom Bearden, he is a correspondent for the NewsHour on PBS and has been in Louisiana this week doing stories for the NewsHour from Louisiana. We continue with the regional coastal advisor for Louisiana State University's Agricultural Center and Louisiana Sea Grant College Program, and we'll also speak with the co-owner of Mariah Jade Shrimp Company. All of that coming up, plus your phone calls at 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we continue our conversation now. We're looking at all the ramifications of the Gulf Coast oil spill, and there are many of them. We have two new guests with us. Mark Schechtsnyder will be here for the rest of the hour, regional coastal advisor for Louisiana State University's Agricultural Center and Louisiana Sea Grant College Programs. And we will also be speaking in a moment with the co-owner of the Mariah Jade Shrimp Company. Mark, thank you very much for joining us. Hello.
My pleasure, Kathleen.
Let's talk a little bit about the environmental impact of this right now. What are you seeing at the moment? What do you fear may happen? And is there anything in the works right now to protect the wildlife in this all-important habitat?
What do we see? Right now we're seeing oil offshore. We've not seen any impacts inside yet. We've had very unusual, not unusual down here, but weather patterns that have kept oil, for the most part, offshore. As you guys know, there's tremendous resources out there poised on top of the oil. They're putting dispersants. They're putting dispersants actually under in the subsea area. There's every parish has submitted emergency plans. There's booms, boats, National Guard. There's a lot of resources poised to try to protect what they can protect if and when the oil comes inshore.
And when you say if and when, do you expect that it will, or are you hopeful that maybe it won't?
Well, I'm a marine biologist. I'm not a climatologist, and I can't control. I mean, we all hope that John Wayne would show up and put a big plug in it, but
right.
It hasn't happened yet.
Right.
But you know, seriously, it could be stopped today, or it could be stopped in weeks, or we would maybe looking in months. We're looking at some very, from almost, I don't want to use the word non-event, but if they stop it now and the attack was out there and the weather patterns hold up, it could be have fairly small impacts.
Right. You just don't know. You're living with uncertainty.
Exactly. And then there's, you know, the more likely scenario is it's going to take weeks or maybe longer, and there's going to be a continued spill. And what isn't caught and boomed or dispersed would be coming on shore. Or the worst case scenario that's out there is, you know, that they would lose the well, which is a whole another, you know, a horse of a different color. It's a very different scenario, and that would be, you know, obviously catastrophic to a lot of industries.
Yes, exactly.
Including the ecology.
Have you been worried for any period of time that this might happen?
I've been a marine biologist in Louisiana for 25 years. I've, you know, ran a marine lab for wildlife and fisheries. I was a shrimp program manager. You know, we live with the oil industry down here. It's a real working coast. You know, you always fear, and I've worked oil spills before, and you know in the back of your mind it could happen, but luckily for all the exploration and the thousands of wells that we've had and the pipelines and everything else, we've been very fortunate that the regulations are in place, they're working, and to keep the oil in the pipes and going to where it needs to go.
Right. And as we move forward on this, do you have any recommendations about what we ought to be doing in this area?
Triple redundancy. we all wish we had three blowout protectors.
Right.
That we can go down, that the little robot could go and press the next button and it
right.
would work. That's to me is something that, and again, this isn't the university's opinion. This is just my personal opinion. I can't understand the risk level and the amount of the lack of protection, the lack of redundancy that was put in place in this, but from what I understand, the situation would be.
Mm-hmm.
I know they had two, one on the surface and one below. But when you're dealing with that kind of risk and then unknown, you step, you know, we've been dealing with risk, living with risk for a long time. And for the last 5 years, you know, really getting our nose stuck in it.
Right.
And good, it's all, you know, it's just, you want to think and you want to be as well planned and protected as possible. And I just, you know, my personal opinion is that there should have been some more safeguards in place.
Right.
And that goes not just to the company, but maybe to the regulators, that, you know, and the Congress and everybody else that's forms what is the regulations for the industry.
Yes, we'll talk more about that as we continue.
Yeah, I listened to your previous guest. He was extremely knowledgeable and laid some of that out well.
Mm-hmm. Kim Chauvin is joining us for a few minutes. We wanted to talk to people who are affected by all of this, their livelihoods affected. She is with the Mary and Jade Shrimping Company in Louisiana. Kim, thank you very much for joining us for a few moments here. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi, Kim. Where are you located in Louisiana?
We are in the central part of Louisiana in a little town called Chauvin, Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. And what's the story now with shrimping along the coast? Has it been halted in federal waters for an indeterminate period of time?
Well, if you look to the east of us, you will see that from Venice on into, I think, around Mobile on the federal waters, that, yes, it is closed. But the central parts of Louisiana and western on is not closed. And, you know, we're trying to be very careful with the issues of putting that there is a closure on all seafood, you know, on all trawling, fishing, crabbing, and shrimping, because there is not. We have our state and federal agencies, I am sure, testing water and checking to see what's good and what's not. And so we are updated with those issues to find out, you know, which parts will be closed and which parts won't. And at this point, we do have commercial fishermen out there in the central and western parts of Louisiana, and they're shrimping right now, and they are catching seafood that has nothing to do with the oil spill whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
So as far as that, you know, trawl vessels migrate from the eastern part of Louisiana and sometimes all the way to Florida back into Texas. That's just one of the things that are done on the bigger boats. The smaller boats pretty much, you know, migrate on the inland areas where they can catch shrimp, and everything just depends. Everything just depends on, you know, what's being caught in the areas and such.
Right. Do you know people who are right now being affected? Do you know people who are doing shrimping who are just have had their money supply cut off because they cannot do their work?
Well, yeah, you have a whole fleet in the Venice area and some of the smaller boats in this area. When they started opening up zones, then your smaller boats throughout the state would be affected. So, yeah, I mean, you know, our whole state is affected as far as those who, you know, migrate from one port to the other.
Right.
And that's the sad part of this, you know, that our whole commercial fishing industry will be affected in that way.
Mm-hmm. Mark, feel free to jump in here, too.
Kim made some really good points. We have over 200 miles of coastline. There's over 75%, about 75% of the whole state has absolutely nothing to do with the closure. And, in fact, even the closed areas haven't seen any oil yet. These are all precautionary measures. But when you put precautionary measures out there and you stop fishing in areas, they stop not just commercial fishing, they stop recreational fishing. So it affects the commercial guys, recreational guys. We have a big industry of people that bring tourists and locals out to go fishing, the charter boat industry.
Right.
Uh-huh. So in this big area, but there's a large, you know, the state is so big and so vast that we have a lot of resources that are being harvested that are perfectly, completely safe to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And even the ones in the closed areas, again, they're closed as precautionary measure. There's nothing wrong with the seafood right now. That could change with oil coming in, but it hasn't yet. And to get the message out that it's okay to eat seafood is very important because, you know, you can, and, you know, cheese is okay. It goes
great. Yeah.
Right.
Well, one of the things that I've said is that if the oil field doesn't ruin our industry, the media outlets just maybe might do that. And this is why, because I've listened to certain entities state that all commercial fishing is closed. Well, there are those of us that still have product, that are getting in product that has nothing to do with the oil spill. And so our vendors are calling in and saying, oh, no. They're saying it's closed. We can't buy that stuff.
And
that's the hurt that gets put on us.
Right.
Yeah. We have, you know, well over 100 million pounds of shrimp in cold storage that was caught this wintertime.
Oh, my.
Last season. I mean, there's lots of them. We produce, you know, just a vast amount of all kinds of different seafoods.
Right.
And there's a lot of stuff that, you know, like Kim was saying, it has nothing to do with the spill, but people see the, you know, and people are very busy, and they see news headlines, and they say Louisiana oil. They think everything's catastrophic, and right now it's not.
Right.
But it's catastrophic for those guys that are sitting at the dock.
Well,
right.
Sure.
They're restricted from going out.
Right.
Or their crab traps are out, and they can't get to them because they're not allowed to go in the water.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, there's also people, you know, when you have an industry like that, you have a lot of workers that are either processing seafood, moving seafood, they're working at oyster docks, unloading sacks, they're picking crab meat, they're running peeling machines. And all these guys now from that area are idle. And so the guys that maybe have 100 people picking crabs, and a lot of these immigrant workers, they're all, you know, if they can't pay them, then they have to send them back home. And it's not so easy just to go restart that engine once you stop it.
Right. Kim, BP said on Monday that it would compensate people for legitimate and objectively verifiable claims from the explosion and spill. Do you understand what that means? Do people understand what that means?
Does anybody really understand what it means? You know, it's going to be subjected to interpretation. And while they can say that, I guess the lawyers will decipher and the judge will decipher what it means for those who are going to file suit. What I think and what's probably going to be done will be two different things. When you look at what Congress allowed after the Valdez, and capping off, it's tragic. I mean, I can't believe. Well, you know what? I can believe our Congress did something this stupid. All you have to do is look at their past history and look at the stupidity going on. But you know, you just capped off something. You've never even thought about worst case scenario because evidently in their mind, Valdez was the worst possible thing that could happen, and here along comes something else. Now, as Mark said, you know, we live with the oil industry here. Did I ever think that this would happen? No, it's not even crossed my mind. But our Congress and the oil companies should be thinking of worst-case scenarios.
Right. Yeah, the risk level is just, as Mark was saying a few moments ago, way too high. You shouldn't live with that kind of risk level. It affects too much.
Well, there are certain, I'm sure after this is, you know, finished with, or even while it's going on, I'm sure Congress is going back to the table on this issue, and there are going to be some serious restrictions. I'm sure the rest of the oil field is going to thank BP in such a huge way, you know, to have all these extra restrictions that are going to be placed on them. But in the meantime, that will not help Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana get back what is going to be owed to them, the commercial fishing industry, the charter fishing industry, the recreational fishing industry, all the tourism parts. I mean, do you honestly think that this company is going to have that type of money to pay every part of these industries back what they would have lost?
What do you say, Mark?
The restrictions we have do work. We just, you know, we need to tighten up certain things. We don't want to give people the impression that there's, you know, 4,000 ticking time bombs, because there's not. We produce oil and gas for the nation on a regular basis. And when I say we, these are actually federal waters. The state of Louisiana gets no royalties and no money, no cost share from these activities, yet we and the other states are shouldering risk for it. We've been trying to push to get a share of offshore oil and gas revenues to start repairing our coast from the damages done from early oil and gas exploration, from navigation improvements that have improved and helped the economy of the entire country. You know, the energy that we produce goes into producing fertilizers. It goes into, you know, a whole that just keeps it keeps the whole economy running. So it's not a Louisiana issue. In this case, it's a federal waters. It's not even, you know, but we're sitting
yes.
here girding for the worst. We weren't at the table on the, you know, from the beginning.
I see. Let's take a couple phone calls. Kim will stay with us for a couple more minutes, and Mark is with us for the rest of the whole hour. Pat from Madison, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hello?
Yes, Pat, go ahead.
Oh, thank you very much. Listen, I just wanted to tell you how much I appreciate this program. And everybody, great to have it. Because my family got scammed in Alaska, commercial fishermen, and they were in one of the hardest hit areas by the Exxon Valdez. And I'm looking back, it's like deja vu, a nightmare. These poor fishermen down in Louisiana, I hope the same thing doesn't happen to them. The scenario in the beginning was, they kind of softened the blow by putting everybody to work and paying them great wages and, you know, $5,000 a day for their boat, and that lasted for a few months, and that kept them quiet. And then they won the court case, and my family was supposed to get like $900,000 to $1 million, and that got appealed. But it went on and on and on for years and years. What they finally got was a check for like $60,000, and these are people that need to make $300,000-$400,000 just to make $60,000 or $50,000 for themselves. And living in Alaska is not cheap. And by the time they pay their cruise and their boat payments,
right.
It was just a horrible, horrible thing. And it affected the fishery. Just, it was devastating. So I hope the same scenario doesn't happen with this deal.
Thank you, Pat, for your call. The phone line is a little shaky, so we'll go to Kim's response first. Kim?
From what he said, you know, it's a lot of what the fishermen are expecting on the backside of this. Yes, they are putting some of our boats to work. No, they're not putting all of our boats to work. The pay, while it isn't fabulous as the $5,000 a day, it is something that gives them, you know, something to go to work, something to accomplish at this time. You know, the sad part is that instead of doing what's right, as far as paying out to those who have been injured, you know, this is going to go to court and stay in the court system for quite some time. And I'm sure that in any oil case spill, they're going to spend more money on that litigation than they would paying you out.
Mm-hmm.
We've
you
been getting a lot of advice and help from our brothers in Alaska, just like we did after the hurricanes, on this issue with the fishermen being dealt with. From the Sea Grant perspective, and also from commercial fishermen and people who are involved in the oil response. So we're always conscious of taking those lessons learned and applying them now so we don't, you know, the same thing doesn't happen again.
Right. Can we spend just a moment here on the dispersant on the news I was watching last night? There was some question about the environmental impact, and I'm wondering what the impact might be on marine life as well of this dispersant that they're using to cut up the leak. What's in that, and is it dangerous, Mark?
It's mostly a detergent.
Oh.
It binds to the molecules of the oil, and it makes them water soluble. And then there's naturally occurring oil in the environment, and there's bacteria that eat oil, hydrocarbon-utilizing bacteria. So the idea with the dispersant is, instead of letting it float on the surface and then impacting bird colonies, we have tremendous wildlife and bird resources down here, from migratory birds to ducks to you name it. We've got the whole smorgasbord. But to stop it from coming on shore, you want to break it up and get it into the water. And I think it's ecologically much better to get it into the water column. And there are things that will naturally weather and eat this. Even when it gets into the marsh, the best thing is sometimes, if it does get in oil and area, the best thing is not to go in there and try to recover it, but let it be on the plants. It coats some of the plant material, the stems. It can be attacked by bacteria. It can weather naturally and break down. And that causes a lot of problems. If you get in there with a bunch of boots and start walking through it, you drive it into the sediments, and then you have it for a long time. And then they're talking about doing things like seeding bacteria, that hydrocarbon-utilizing bacteria right on it to break it up. So I like the fact that they're trying to disperse it. I mean, it's still in the water column. You're still dealing with hydrocarbons, but you're not getting that surface impact.
Right.
Getting in these very fragile areas. Like in some cases, in the worst-case scenario, if you get a lot of oil in there, it can kill all the plants. And with our tremendous coastal wetland loss rates because of the navigation channels and the channel of the Mississippi River and the water and sediments don't flow out naturally like they used to, once you lose an area, it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you go back and physically build it back with dredges and or better yet, a sustainable restoration project in that area.
Mm-hmm. And Kim, finally to you, how is this spill affecting your day-to-day life and the work that you're doing? Are you interrupted here, or you said that a lot of people are continuing in waters that are safe? Are things going to be okay for you and your business for a little while?
Well, on our part, while we are conducting shrimp business, we are helping more with the cleanup at this part.
I see.
We have been putting boats, selecting boats that are about 50 foot and bigger to get out there for the oil spill cleanup. I think they're calling them task force or whatever, that they put so many boats in the task force and get out there and clean up. And so our worry is that it's going to come this way. And with that, our bigger boats have decided that they want to get into the eastern part of our state and try and do some cleanup on there, in hopes that it won't ever come this way. That's what most of our boats are doing right now. We've had two different waves of boats that have gone over into the eastern part of Louisiana to help with the cleanup at this point. Our first wave just got there and is beginning to work on it.
Thank you so much, Kim, for being with us. Best of luck to you.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, Kim Chauvin, our guest for part of the program, co-owner of Mariah Jade Shrimp Company. Mark is staying with us, regional coastal advisor for Louisiana State University's Agricultural Center and Louisiana Sea Grant College Program. He is a marine biologist and will welcome many more phone calls as we continue here this Tuesday. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, Michael Lewis will join us, author of the number one book on the New York Times list, and that is called The Big Short, Inside the Doomsday Machine. He is considered to be the finest reporter on giving us a deep understanding of what the heck happened on Wall Street. He's written a number of other best-selling books and is a one-time Wonder Boy himself on Wall Street. He also wrote The Blind Side. He's a man of many talents. He will join us, and Mike Allen will also join us. You may have seen the New York Times Magazine section the week before last. Huge story on Mike Allen and the influence of his playbook on Politico. So that's coming up, hour number two. Let's go to more phone calls for Mark Schechsnyder, and we go to Rick from La Crosse next. Hi, Rick.
Hi. I heard about the accident so many days ago, and all this time, all I hear about is the Gulf states being affected, the Florida Keys, maybe the North Atlantic seaboard. But nobody talks about all the other countries that are in the Caribbean, in the Gulf of Mexico, and I think that's kind of ethnocentric, and it's like this is a huge oil spill. I saw the satellite images. They're really huge. They're like islands within themselves. I mean, I saw the NOAA, whatever, satellite image, and it was this huge slick that was coming out from the bottom of the ocean and about the size of, oh gosh, Jamaica, Cuba, and nobody mentions all the other countries that can be affected.
Okay. Are other countries possibly affected here, Mark?
When you look at it, the Landsat, what you're seeing mostly is a sheen. It's not really thick islands of oil, but it's more, everything reflects off of the satellite imagery. So when you're seeing a big area, and Rick's right, it is a huge area that's covered. The good thing right now is that it's a sheen, and there's only certain smaller areas that have concentrated oil. And of course, the booms are working, and skimmers are trying to pick that oil up as they can and get dispersants on it to break it up. And that's not to say that something, if it gets to be much larger, then there's a whole different, there's a different scenarios of what we have now. If they get under control quickly, if it just leaks the way it is for a longer period of time, or if they lose control. So you have a lot of different scenarios. Luckily, we're in that first, the first and second area right now. I don't anticipate other countries being affected right now with what we're looking at. But everything could change in a second if their well would blow or something else would happen. But it's not right now. I think you're going to see more. Now, if you had even a persistent spill that would move into the shipping areas and would close the river, you guys and the whole economy would be affected broadly because it would disrupt shipping patterns.
Right.
There's a lot of grain that comes down the river, a lot of coal that goes back up, comes down, goes across to Florida. There's a lot, we're one of the biggest port conglomerates in the whole world in southeast Louisiana, and those are dependent a lot on intercoastal but also deep water shipping access. And if the oil gets into those areas, then it starts to affecting those things. But to answer Rick's question about the Caribbean and the islands, with the water patterns and the circulation patterns and the size of the, and really what we're seeing is the sheen right now with pockets of oil in it, it's not as big as it looks on it, but I'm not downplaying it in any way, shape, or form. I'm as sick as everybody is to see oil possibly impacting the coast, killing birds.
Sure,
doing sea turtles. There's all kinds of parameters that could be affected, and are being affected right now. But it's not. When you look at it, you got to realize that a lot of that is just a thin coat on the. When you put a few drops of oil in a bucket of water.
Thanks very much, Rick, for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. Here's an email that's come in from Frank. Has the government taken note of the standards in place for the Norwegian North Sea oil fields? Automatic acoustic shutoff valves are required. They are not in place at Horizon.
I've been following with some of the subsea engineers, and I work with on a certain thing, but I'm not an engineer. I do understand that they are in place in certain countries, and I also understand that a lot of the wells, the deep water wells in this country, have those same cutoffs. I can't answer why it's not mandated here. Certainly, as a citizen anywhere in the country, I would hope that we have those mandated for those, especially for those there's potentially, you know, the risk that we're dealing with.
Yes. It should be just standard practice at this point, of course.
Yeah,
we're looking now, we're saying, how in the world could this not be?
But, you know, and they did have some controls. And like I was telling when Kim was saying, we do, you know, the industry is safe. We produce a lot of oil and gas. So, you know, we've got billions of dollars worth of product that comes across our coast in pipelines and drilling rigs. We have over 4,000 rigs in the coastal waters alone in Louisiana. And you never, there's very few spills. There's a lot of regulations there. Is there enough? No.
No, there isn't.
No, if you have something like this, I mean, it's
right.
Like I said, the engineers I talked to said they're just they're aghast that there wasn't triple redundancy on some of these platforms. But I'm not an engineer, but I do understand what I'm looking at right now, and I'm as unhappy as anybody.
Yes. Thanks, Rick, for your call.
Great point.
Thank you, Frank, for your email. It was good as always. Joanne from Prairie Farm. Hi, Joanne.
Hi. I just am calling because I got a question that I want to ask. Why can't this be skimmed off and vacuumed into tankers that will take it to a refinery?
Believe me, there's an armada of boats that are skimming oil. What happens with the oil in the water is it turns into a mousse. It starts gathering water inside, and it's a sort of chocolate pudding kind of consistency. So you've got a product that's got a lot of water in it, but it's also still oil. They're skimming as fast as they can. They've got, we have Thad Allen. They put him in charge a few days ago. He's incredible, focused. He's got Army situation awareness that you need everything that it can be done with the resources is being done beyond just what BP can do. But as far as refining that oil, once it's picked up, it's got a lot of water in it. I'm not sure what the process is right now. They're very focused on just getting it out the water, getting the leak. Number one, getting the leak stopped. Number two, getting it out the water offshore. Number three, preventing it from coming inshore. And number four, mitigating damages that would happen if the oil does come inshore. So there's a series of things, and right now we're really focused on just stopping it. But it's a good point. I think it maybe could be utilized. I'm just not sure what the water and what it does to the oil, if it can be refined at that point.
And what's in place right now to protect and to clean the wildlife who may be damaged by the oil? Our first guest, Tom Bearden, did a piece on the News Hour yesterday, the day before, about 50 journalists taking pictures of one bird that had been covered with oil, which is horrendous. But they were expecting, I think, much more of that.
That bird was brown before the oil got on it.
Oh, really?
It's a cormorant.
Oh.
But it's okay. I mean, just people are anxious. People want to know.
Sure.
They want to see. And the weather's been very, you know, it's been our friend for the most part. It's hard to work out there because it's, you know, 8 to 10 foot seas. If you haven't been out in that kind of weather, it's just
sure.
It's very difficult working conditions. But it also has been breaking up the oil spill. It's been driving in different areas. Now we have a slight north wind for the next day or two. And if you guys could send some more fronts down, that would anything you can do.
We'll do our best.
Yeah.
Well. So plans are in place in case the worst happens.
There's booms. They're calling for up to 3 million feet of booms.
Wow.
Every single parish has done a
worst-case
scenario. This is what we need. They're hiring boats. I mean, they just and to answer your question about the wildlife, there's hundreds of people, and in fact, thousands of people are being trained to clean birds if it gets to that point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, hundreds of people, not thousands, but there's a lot of different efforts on all kinds of levels, and they've got companies in place. They're hiring. I get emails and calls for volunteers. I direct them to the places that are taking the volunteers, and there's other people. There's whole Coast Guard training for fishermen, which is very important. A lesson we learned in Valdez is you don't go send fishermen out without getting trained on hazmat, handling the hazardous materials.
Right.
You want it to be safe, just like when you're cleaning up. You don't want to create more problems. You don't want to create health issues in people that don't have health issues,
right?
By being too hasty, and it's, you know, again, these lessons we've learned the hard way from past oil spills and hurricanes.
Who's paying for this? BP.
at the end of the day, that's who's going to pay for it, I think. If it's, you know, if it escalates, and I'm not saying it is going to, but right now it's everything's pointing to BP. And like Kim said, I know fishermen that have gotten 15 calls from different lawyers. There's going to be a lot of litigation for the rest of my career and beyond on this issue. At the end of the day, BP, I think, is the party they're looking at. But, of course, you got other companies that are involved, and there's a lot of, you know, posturing going on. I'm trying to focus on the problem at hand and trying to help as much as we can to keep the loss as low as it is.
Yes.
Whether it's bioremediation, helping educate about cleanup situations, helping with the fishermen deal with the immediate impact and long-term impacts.
Our number, we have some lines open, 800-486-8655. And our guest till the end of the hour is Mark Schechthyder. He is Regional Coastal Advisor for Louisiana State University's Agricultural Center and Louisiana Sea Grant College Program. And he is a marine biologist. And we go to Jim next from Larson. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question regarding, we hear over and over again that this oil is to help with the United States' energy security. Now, is it not true that this oil is just put on the market and sold to the highest bidder?
Mark, I don't know if you want to take that on or not. It's outside
well,
your area.
I think Jim's correct. It's part of the whole energy supply. I mean, and that opens up the whole debate of where our energy comes from. Why are we not conserving more to begin with? I mean, you can go any direction with that. But at the end of the day, any oil and gas that we produce domestically is not oil and gas we have to buy from someone else.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, though, that this opens for a long period of time? We tend to be people who don't think much beyond the next 5 minutes. But it seems as though it's going to open a more rigorous debate about the safety of certain kinds of energy and the safeguards that need to be in place. And don't you think we have to have that discussion more completely right now after this?
Oh, I'm hoping and praying that we don't forget about it. If, you know, if they shut the valve off today and we clean up what's gone and we don't just let this pass without really learning some hard lessons from it about how we act with the whole energy policy, where we get our fuel from, regulations, you know, there's all kinds of good things that can come from this in the end if we use the opportunity right.
Mm-hmm. Our number is 800-486-8655, and if you would like to send an email, as Frank did, our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. In terms of, this is kind of a day-by-day thing, today looks a little better than yesterday did in terms of where the winds are. It seems to me as though it's quite a fluid situation, Mark, and I'm wondering what everybody, people like you, have to be prepared for in the next few days. What are your hopes and what are your fears?
We're, you know, I think the president said it the best, that, and the governor and everybody is echoing it. We're preparing for the very worst, and we're hoping for the best, and we're preparing for the very worst. And my fear is if they would lose control of the well, and you would have orders of magnitude more oil coming out than right now. That's the biggest fear. What we have right now, everything in place, it's not going to be pretty. If it would stop right now, I think we have a, you know, controllable situation that's going to be not catastrophic at all. We should be able to get back to business fairly quickly, and that's an if, you know. And it, like you say, it's different from a hurricane because you can see where the sucker is and you know what size it is and you know it's going to pass, and you'll be like, right now we just don't know if and when it's going to stop, which makes it very hard to plan. But
right,
we're planning for the very worst scenarios. Like I was saying, they're putting between, they're trying to get between 3 and 5 million feet just to booms. That's just
the
boom. That's not the skimmer of boats. That's not the fishermen. That's not, that's, you know, just one aspect of the resources being thrown at this thing.
Yeah. Danny from Green Bay. Hi. Running short on time. Hi, Danny.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up 2 points. I was listening to Democracy Now! Yesterday, and they had the author of a book called Not One Drop or something along those lines. And she made 2 points. Number one, after the Exxon Valdez, there's like an oil compact or something signed that said that oil companies couldn't be liable up to 70, or are only liable up to like $75 million. And the other point that was brought up was health issues that come from cleanup like this aren't necessarily covered under OSHA or under some sort of like health reimbursement program. And I just wanted to see if your guest could comment on the validity of those two.
All right. Can you take just the second, because we're almost out of time here. We've got 30 seconds.
Our Congress people right are meeting as we speak with BP and the Minerals Management Service to change those regulations, those liability questions, and on the health issues, we're hazmat training everybody before they go out, which I don't believe was done in Alaska.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark, so much for being with us. I hope that
you're welcome.
Best
I appreciate you guys' concern, and I just want to give you all a hoot at before we leave.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. Our guest this whole hour, Mark Schechsnyder, Regional Coastal Advisor for Louisiana State University's Agricultural Center. We also thank Tom Bearden from PBS NewsHour and Kim Chauvin, owner of Mariah Jade Shrimp Company. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, Connor O'Brien for on-air production. More coming up soon.